Maybe we could start with the title that you've given to your memoir. This is, I understand, actually a quote from something that Stieg Larsson wrote to you.
Yeah, it's called "There Are Things I Want You to Know," and it's a quote from a goodbye letter that Stieg wrote to me in 1977 when he was going to Ethiopia in Africa first, and he thought he might not come out of there alive because there was a civil war going on. And this is a quote from that goodbye letter. And so the title was used here in the US. It was the my publisher in New York who thought it would be changed from the original one, Millennium Stieg and Me. And I thought it was a great title, There Are Things I Want You to Know. I should have thought of it myself.
Well, I think it's perfectly appropriate for the millions of Americans who have read the Millennium Trilogy. There are, in fact, things that we want to know about Stieg Larsson, and you are our best source.
Yeah, I guess so.
One of the things I found fascinating in reading There Are Things I Want You to Know is the number of places and people that we know from reading the Millennium Trilogy, which apparently are real places and people. They are things from Stieg's life and from yours. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So that also explains why there was hardly any research done. There were 2,000 pages written in almost exactly 2 years, and during that time, the amount of writing to be done, it's natural that you can't do that much research. And some writers also use a lot of their personal knowledge and experience and people and places and so on. So that's what happened.
Still, it's a surprise, I think, to many of the readers who know how much there is to tell in these about real life and about the issues, to learn that these are simply a part of your lives. These were not specially researched subjects that he went into in order to write these books.
No, that's true. Yeah, and I think that's also one of the reasons that the Millennium books ring so true to people. They feel there's a real reality there, quite complex and so on. So that's what also, I think that was a good point writing, actually, using your life and your experiences like this.
Can you give me an example? I mean, I'm assuming that Lisbeth Salander is not a real person, but perhaps an amalgamation of ideas and people that he and you had met?
Yeah, she's a mix of quite a lot of people. I have to say both men and women. So it's not just based on women that we knew and worked with, but also some men. And actually, there's quite a lot of Stieg himself in Lisbeth Salander. It's her stubbornness and her absolute determination to get justice at whatever cost. So that's very much his attitude to things that really upset him.
I can almost hear you smile as you say that.
I was.
In terms of character, there's obviously a lot to be talked about. He must have been an extraordinary man to spend time with, not always necessarily in a happy way.
I would like to say always in a happy way. Of course, we had a lot of problems with his research and writing on the extreme right wing and the anti-Semitism and racial stuff they were putting out. But we had a good life. We were happy together. We could overcome the problems by making each other secure and so on. So I have no regrets about that at all.
And for you then, reading The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, even though it reminds you of some unpleasant things out of that, must be a joy in some ways because he still lives there and some of the people, in fact, I suppose you do.
No, I can't say that. Not really, no. For the rest of the world, maybe. That's their introduction to Stieg Larsson. That's how new readers, new people who never met him or me would feel like they're somehow connected to the author. But for me, it's actually our life and other stuff that reminds me of in places, personal places and personal things and so on. So.
I want to talk a little bit about the places in the trilogy and that you talk about in the book. He, you say, was raised by his grandparents in northern Sweden, in a part of the country that most of us outside of Sweden will never have seen or heard of. It must have been extraordinary then, while being ordinary for him.
It's a very place off the road, off the charts almost, in the inland of the northern Sweden, but quite a poor area. People had nothing, and what little they had, they shared. That's what they had been doing for generations on, and that's how come they survived. And it creates people with integrity and character and a sense of helping each other out and so on. And they also become very stubborn, which I can, which I really can underline that Stieg was. And also very, you know, self-sufficient in a good way, also very social. So it was probably the best upbringing he could have.
Geographically, where is this? Are there places in the books that we've read that place names that we would recognize now?
Stieg was brought up with his maternal grandparents outside of Norsjö, and that is actually where Mikael Blomqvist's research takes him in the first Millennium book when he's tracking this car and the old wedding photos, wedding trip photos, to find out the murderer of Harriet Wanger. So that's where he ends up. And that's sort of a tribute Stieg gives to the people up there, the ones he knew and the ones who sort of shaped him as a person.
The strong and the stubborn and the caring that we see in the books and that he must have seen in his real life.
Yeah, it's very, very similar. I think that's how he looked also at people who were sort of the right kind of people to be heroes as well. You know? I mean, it's a common quality for all the good guys in Millennium, actually.
How did he come to be there? Why was he not raised by his parents?
Well, the only explanation I've heard is that they were too young to take care of him. They were about 19, and this was their first child, so that's the explanation I've heard. But then he stayed on there for 9 years.
It's the 9 years that makes that difficult to comprehend, isn't it?
Because exactly, yeah. Yeah, that makes it strange, because they did get jobs, they did get an apartment, they did get a second son, and still Stieg was left up there. And he probably would have stayed up there much longer if his grandfather hadn't suddenly died. So I really don't know what happened, and Stieg didn't know either, so he had no explanation either.
You, I gather, were also raised in a household without a mother. You grew up with your father?
Yeah. My mother was around until I was about 9, and then they got a divorce. So my father raised me and my siblings, but also my paternal grandparents raised us. So to say, they were living in a house close by. So I have the same experiences as Stieg of getting the knowledge and the attitude of an older generation that somehow had its roots in the 19th century. So it's kind of antique.
Well, you must have seen that in each other. Perhaps that was part of the appeal that you had for each other when you first met.
I think so, yeah, and the stubbornness.
And the stubbornness. And you were both very young when you met early on, weren't you both just going into college?
Yeah, just 18, yeah. and just by chance, I was going to my first political meeting ever. It was a meeting against the Vietnam War in 1972. And Stig was sort of the host there to greet people and try to talk to them what they were there for and so on. And he had been active for almost 2 years then. So he started early, started around 16 being a political activist.
So politics brought you together and in many ways kept with you. I won't say it kept you together, but it was part of the glue of your relationship for the rest of your life together.
Yeah, and also a great curiosity in society in general, without necessarily turning it into politics. How does things work, and why, and how do people work, and what does the world look like, and so on. So we had these constant discussions all the time, and I remember always being a bit confused when I saw couples in cafes or restaurants and so on, and they were not talking to each other. And I never experienced that with Stig. We had always these discussions going on. You know, what have you done today? What have you found out? Have you read this article? Do you know what's going on there? And so on. So we sort of, I think one could say that we did more than grow up together. We matured together.
And it's not as though you simply agreed with each other on everything. You were happily engaged in the discussion. But, for instance, you write about being Maoists, I think, when in your early political life, and
not me,
not you,
not me, no. I think Stig ended up there for a very short time. He sort of slipped into it because he had friends there, and I really couldn't stand that sort of sectarian, undemocratic, and rather stupid ideas on how to behave or what politics should be. It wasn't just naive. It was I felt that it was too high-handed and too. Commanding of people, too much of an, I wouldn't say dictatorship, but it was something wrong with the attitude towards people and how to run things and how to make people collaborate. It was more on giving orders than having true, proper, free discussions and see where that would take you.
And eventually he came to agree with you. Did you persuade him, or did he simply realize come to a new realization?
He didn't want to realize anything. There was lots of screaming and discussions for, I think, the better part of a year. It was really, really tough. I thought he was so stupid. This was a smart man. Why couldn't he see what I saw? So it took about a year, but yeah.
And is this the period when he went off to Africa?
Yeah, right after that he went off to Africa. He wanted to try out. I think actually his main reason was personal. He had some kind of political assignment as well. I don't know what it was, carrying documents or probably money or something like that to one group or the other down there in the civil war in Ethiopia. But actually, I think the real driving force for him was to try to become a stringer, a foreign correspondent for one of the big Swedish newspapers, and to write about this, because at this time there were no journalists in Ethiopia at all. I actually spoke to Swedish war correspondents later on, and they said that they were forbidden by their media houses or newspapers to go there, because they would be killed. But so Stig was, in fact, probably one of the few, if not to say the only, journalist in Ethiopia at the time. And unfortunately, nobody was interested in his writings.
This is a recurring issue, though we all know that he was a good writer. There were those who said he wasn't and never would be.
Mm. Yep, I heard that not really when he was alive, because he did have some you know, status. He would absolutely speak out if anyone would say that about him or to him. But after his death, that started to turn up that Stieg couldn't write and so on. And that's one of the things I had to include in my book, to say that this wasn't true. Because the next thing that would come is that I wrote Millennium, and I think that's really disrespectful of Stieg, so I had to include that too. I don't know why people say things like that. Is it old envy or what? I'm starting to suspect it is that.
What happened to him in Africa? He was there for a while and then came back.
Yeah, he traveled around both in Ethiopia, of course, and in Kenya and Uganda. And I think he came back to Ethiopia as well. And he became very, very ill there and almost died. He got some after effects of having gotten malaria. So his kidneys just shut down, and He woke up in this hospital in Addis Ababa, and that's when he wrote to me and said that he was coming home. He'd had enough. He wanted to start a new life with me now. This was it for him.
Were you surprised to hear from him, to hear that he was coming home?
No. Of course I knew he would be coming home. I was just surprised that the strength of the conviction that, I've done this now. I need to build up a new life, and I want to do it with you, so let's do it. It was stronger than I ever heard before. It wasn't just coming home.
That has to have put a smile on your face, because you felt the same way about him.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's when we moved to the capital of Sweden, Stockholm. Quite far from where we both grew up, and that's where we built up the rest of our life together.
Well, and that involved some of the same things that we see again in the story of Lisbeth Salander, really in the life of Michael Blomqvist, the parts of him that are Stieg. He came back, and the two of you helped put together a journal, the anti-racism journal called Expo.
Mm. It was mainly Stieg. I was involved in trying to set it up. It took a few years, I didn't write any articles in it, but I helped out. I did translations. I did some editing of Stieg's text when he wanted to, or did graphics, or actually gave money and so on. So you can't say that I was part of the editorial board or anything like that. I don't want to take away anything from the young kids who were actually doing such an enormous work on their spare time and not giving up, even though they were personally threatened by the extreme right wing.
This is a thing that I think it's hard for people to understand, is that these were real threats. The stories that Expo was intent on revealing were a threat in a real sense to the racist movements in Sweden. Yeah. We don't tend to think of those as being real in Sweden, but they were very much so.
Oh, yeah. I mean, their convictions for... there's one conviction in 1993 when the Storm Network, their young Nazis, sort of put out in their magazine... all the personal data on Stieg and his collaborator on a book on the extreme right wing. This was sort of, they sort of said that it's okay to go out and kill them. And this was being directed towards two journalists. This is a crime against the Constitution. So... It became that kind of a trial, and they were convicted. And that was just the first one, rather mild one. These people went on to not just beating people up, but actually executing immigrants and In 1999, they shot two police officers who were trying to catch some guys who had committed a bank robbery. So it's violent people, and bank robberies were one of their means to finance their politics. So they meant business, and they still do.
Again, it gives us some of the background for the stories that we've read, because you can see how Stieg Larsson would not need to do any further research to know the kind of things that Mikael Blomqvist was going to have to face and that Lisbeth Salander was going to have to try to uncover.
Yeah, because the Wanger family is partly an old Nazi family.
A real Nazi family.
Yeah.
Based on one of
the family members, the brothers who was killed in the civil war in Finland. He was a Nazi in uniform and all, and this sort of shines through the culture that this family has. They aren't Nazis, the rest of them, but still there's this culture that's quite oppressive to everyone.
There are a number of characters, I gather, who are drawn from life, if not from specific people. Can you give us an example of people you know or stories you know that were retold in the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo books?
Well, we have the forensic psychiatrist Svante Brandén, who's the one who goes on the witness stand to sort of refute Lisbeth Salander's crazy psychiatrist, this Teleborian guy. And Svante Brandén is what he is in real life, as he is in the books. Very nice guy, very upright. Another one is the doctor who saves Lisbeth Salander, is also one of our friends. Both of them were able to read what was written about them. And I know, for instance, that the doctor who saves Lisbeth Salander, he had quite a few comments on how to operate in the brain. So it's quite well researched.
Of course, one of the characters in the books is Blomqvist's sister, and she's quite a hero or heroine, if you like, which is odd because in Larsson's life, family is you. Family is not a blood relative.
Hmm. Well, he had my siblings. He used to call my sister his sister because he always wanted a sister, so... He sort of adopted her as his new sibling. So, because actually, now that you mention it, he grew up as an only child. That's quite true. I think he missed having siblings.
You talk about Stieg Larsson and growing up with his grandparents. His parents left him there for 9 years. What was his relationship with his father and his brother? And were you at all close with his family?
Well, I met Stieg at 18, as I said, and already then I thought there was a kind of not really close relationship between him and his biological family at all. And it sort of stayed that way, especially with his brother. His brother only actually came to all our different homes twice in his whole life during the more than 30 years than Stieg and I were together. And the second time was actually after Stieg was dead. That says something. So it was a distant relationship. And I think it comes from being away from them for 9 years and coming back to them as a sort of fully developed, even though young, character. I guess I did what anyone does with their partner's family. You sort of adopt those relations as they are. You don't become best friends with somebody your partner is trying to ward off or stay away from, but sort of keep at a distance. It just doesn't work like that. So unfortunately, his mother died. She died in the early 1990s, and she and I got along very well. There was some friction between her and Stig, and I think that's actually because they were so alike. That's also, I guess, why I liked her so much. She was one great lady.
Such a shame.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very good. Thanks again. And I hope you have a good trip. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it leads to the other part of the story. We can't really leave the conversation without talking about a couple of other things. You lived with Stig Larsson for most of 3 decades.
Yeah.
But you were never married and never had children, so under Swedish law, I understand you have no rights to his estate. Is that right?
No, I have no rights at all. The law is very antiquated, and I think the worst of it is that people in my situation, they can't even go to court. We aren't allowed to let a judge decide or a jury decide if this is a reasonable outcome or not after 10 or 12 or 20 or 30 years of living together.
It's hard to understand from our perspective because that is certainly not true here. It could be contentious, and many are, but you say you have no standing even to contest the estate.
Yeah, I have no standing. There's no provisions in the law for anything like that. And that also, so that means that this is a problem that doesn't just has affected me, but lots of people whose life are completely crushed and families are torn apart and almost at civil war. And so it's continuous. And even if you have children, the children would inherit. So that might, in some cases, become even a bigger problem because that might mean that the surviving mother or father would have to sell the home because of the children has to have their inheritance. So it doesn't really work out in the best interest of people anymore.
In your case, there has been some discussion over the years since Stig Larsson's death, is there not, between you and his father and brother?
Well, I tried to. I didn't understand what was going on for the better part of the first year after Stig died. And I thought they were making mistakes when they were selling the film rights. So my then legal advisor drafted a proposal that I would manage the literary legacy because I thought the family was making a mistake. And they didn't want that at all.
Do you still wish that you could maintain his literary legacy?
Yeah, of course. what's left of it? I guess most rights have been sold already. So, but it's still there's still more than the Millennium Trilogy. I mean, after all, he was writing all his life. So, and in the journalistic sense, articles or books on the extreme right wing or articles on science fiction and so on. So there's quite a lot, not quite a lot, but there's some stuff left that I think should be managed in a respectful way.
But they don't allow you to do that?
No, I think they want the possibility of selling off freely and not bother really to manage any literary estate because it takes time, it takes an effort. You have to check the translations, you have to check the marketing, you have to okay the covers, you have to go on tours. And there's a lot of work involved, and you can only really do that if you're interested in the subjects or in the person that you are sort of representing.
So you still have some hope that they will let you take care of that?
I don't know. I just know that I had to do what I had to do, and that was to get my life in order and write this book and so have my say and let it be at that.
Well, it does lead us to the question of the rumored fourth volume of the series. Can I ask you, does it exist?
I kind of think that's an interesting rumor. It's obvious that this mega business wants to publish more Millennium books. So the rumor is that there is a fourth volume. I've never seen a fourth volume. I do know there's a fragment of a book, which I have estimated to about 200 pages based on what I saw in late August. Stig died 2 months later.
The story goes it's on a laptop that you may know the location of.
May or may not. This is a legal hassle, and I don't want to be subjected to any more threats of house searches or stuff like that. So not me or anyone. So I really can't talk about it. But it's just a fragment. And what do you do with a fragment? I know what Stig's writing process was like, and it wasn't really that continuous. He didn't have this synopsis or well thought out plan on where things would go. He could write scraps or nice scenes and sometimes continuous dialogues. And so these 200 pages or whatever it is probably aren't in sequence either. So what's the point of doing that unless you want to start some ghost writing business? And I don't think that would be right.
I'm curious, though, to ask you, because you did understand him so well. I know that you have said you did not have anything to do with the writing of the trilogy, that it was all Stieg Larsson. You were so close to him. You were simpatico. You were partners. Would you consider writing something in the line that he did because you understood those issues and knew the same people?
I thought about it, actually. But given what I've been through, even though it's a big success and so on, given what I've been through, I sort of lost heart, you know. I offered to try to finish the fourth, provided I would get the rights to do so, which... And these rights were to manage the literary legacy. Without that legal right, I can't do anything. And I did that in earnest, hoping that I would do something good for the family and for Stig and so on. And this just caused... years of struggle and paying lawyers and things like that. So just try to fight off... a total exploitation and pressure on me and on him, even though he's dead. So I don't know. I don't feel the same enthusiasm anymore.
You will perhaps forgive us if we hope that you find it again.
Yes, I'll think about it.
Eva Gabrielsen, please, thank you very much.
Thank you.